From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, amidst the threat of tariffs, automakers ask President-elect Trump for clarity.
And basically, the attitude is, we'll accommodate, we'll adjust to whatever, just tell us what it is.
Going back in history and digging up the true cause of the Flint water disaster.
We're missing the bigger picture of state policy that supported suburbanization for many decades.
A federal program helping small Great Lakes businesses.
Our role is really to, you know, help them steady themselves and identify ways that they can improve their business and their competitiveness and to remain employers.
And a short story contest just for Michigan writers.
There are people all around Michigan who are incredibly talented, who have been holding a story in their heart. And when they share that with others, they are rewarded and it can change their life.
Hello and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. This is a busy and important week for elected officials all across our state. The legislature begins a new session with a new House Speaker and 43 new representatives. We'll be talking with some of them throughout the week. But first, for the first time in 7 years, an elected Detroit school board is in place. The board officially took control of the school district January 1st after nearly 20 years of state-appointed management. 63 candidates were on the ballot. The voters chose 7 to make up this new school board. One of those 7 is Sonia Mays. She graduated from Detroit Renaissance High School and then went on to the University of Michigan, where she worked her way to a bachelor's, an MBA, and then her law degree. She is president and CEO of Develop Detroit. It's a nonprofit group working to rebuild and strengthen city neighborhoods, and she's with us now. Welcome. Sonia, what do you think voters expect of you and the other board members?
So the number one thing that I think voters expect from this new school board is they have an expectation that there will be focused leadership from this group, that it will be credible, it'll be committed, and that it will consistently make decisions that are in the best interest of Detroit school children.
What is your personal mission statement?
So I am a huge believer in public education. I think that public education is one of the most progressive things that this country has ever done. It ranks up there with Social Security and free libraries. It is, without question, our best chance at equalizing many of the disparities that exist in our society. And public education is something that is worth protecting, it's worth defending, it's worth fighting for. And I think that responsibility falls to all of us. It shouldn't just be on the backs of people with school-age children. If you're a business owner, if you are a community leader, if you just get up every day and go to your job at the mall, somehow, somewhere in all of that, there is an impact that occurs because of the quality of our public education system. So I am very passionate about defending it and about creating an environment where Detroit children can expect to have a robust set of opportunities.
Sonia Mays, you and other members of the board will be plunging headfirst into a big, big list of must-dos. But before we get into those, I'm interested in how you think this new board will interact and work together, because there were well-documented issues of politicking and squabbling and infighting that, you know, hindered the effectiveness of previous boards. What will be crucial from your point of view in making sure that the members of this board remain focused on the students and on the schools?
Well, let me tell you what we've done to date. I think this is something that I really do want the broader community to know and understand. So nearly immediately after the election, the 7 of us started to, in a very structured way, both spend time with each other, get to know each other, as well as do really formalized training on what it means to be a good high-performing school board and what it means to be good decision makers in this environment. And all told, we spent nearly 50 hours of one-on-one time in a room, in a conference room, working with each other, working with wonderful organizations like Wayne Risa and the Michigan Association of School Boards. And so even before we became official on January 1, we had put significant time and effort into this. And so I think what you're going to see is, again, a very dedicated, very credible group of people who have taken a lot of time and have done it very intentionally to get to know each other and to try to shape shape right out of the gate what our agenda will look like.
And it, with that in mind, with the agenda, how are you, if you will, triaging the to-do list? There are a lot of issues facing Detroit schools and the students, and here you are, the first elected Detroiters to get a say-so in what happens in the city schools in years.
Oh my goodness, there's so much that's going to come at us right out of the gate. And so, and I think we're really prepared for it, but I think it's important to underscore just how much responsibility this board is going to have to manage and guide through the first 6 months alone. So let me just tick through the list. In the first first 90 days, we have to make a decision on a permanent superintendent. We have an SRO school closure process that is going to come into play very shortly. There are expiring collective bargaining agreements that will end at the end of this school year that involve the teachers. And then finally, we also have to complete the integration of the EAA schools back into DPS. I mean, any one of those things is a sort of a, would be a monumental all hands on deck project for a school board, and we have to be prepared to grapple with all of those seemingly at the same time. And so that's kind of the piece that I call sort of the urgent to-do list. And then at the same time, we have to very methodically start to create a set of policies that will lay the groundwork for long-term planning in the district.
We are talking with Sonia Mays, who's one of the new seven members of the Detroit School Board, rolling up their sleeves and beginning work this week officially, although as we've heard, there have been weeks of preparation going on. What are your thoughts about a superintendent? As you say, you've got 90 days to choose a new one. Are you considering interim Superintendent Alicia Merriweather?
To date, let me answer that question directly. Superintendent Merriweather has done a fantastic job. She has stepped into an extraordinarily difficult situation and by all accounts has performed remarkably. However, I'll say that this board is really focused at this point in time on a process. We want to make sure that every step of the way in everything we do, not just a superintendent search, but everything we do, that there's a well-communicated, well-thought-out plan and process for how we operate. And I think there is no place that is where that's more true or more important than the decision on who is going to be the final superintendent. So I think what you'll watch for from us is just a well-thought-out process that starts with what is our mission, what is our vision, and then a clear articulation of the skill set behind the person who's going to take us there.
And as you mentioned, the EAA experiment is ending, so the board will be bringing these Education Achievement Authority schools, the state-run district, back into the Detroit fold. How do you think, Sonia, you're going to work out the differences between what the non-union EAA teachers were been making with the unionized Detroit employees? Is there much of a gap?
There is definitely a gap. This is a question that I am neither authorized to speak on behalf of the board, so I want to be clear about that. But it's also a place that Judge Rhodes, as transition manager, spent a lot of time thinking through and laying the groundwork for. And so over the next few weeks, we'll continue to get briefings on where that body of work stands and the best way to integrate not just the physical assets back into the district, but as you mentioned, the most critical element. And it's hopefully bringing those teachers back in a way that works for them as well as works for existing DPS teachers.
Sonia, right now, as we all know, there's a big push and pull happening over whether the state is required to close every school in Detroit that's been at the bottom 5% on the state test score rankings for three straight years. We know that there's a view that has been backed by the governor that the new law should not apply to Detroit schools because they are in a new district. And then we had last fall Attorney General Schuette saying, no, schools in the bottom 5% for 3 years should be closed, all of them. And I know you're a community organizer. What is your take on this?
First and foremost, I always go back to the overarching objective of the SRO, and that is to make sure that children in Michigan and children in Detroit are not subject to non-performing schools. And I don't think there's a single parent in Detroit who would argue that objective. Detroit parents want the same thing that parents in other communities want. They want safe, high-quality educational options for their children. And so on that point, I think that there's very little dissent. And so ultimately, what we are debating, if you will, is the right pathway, the right process to get to higher performing schools. And as a community developer, I am very strongly opposed to the closing of schools, particularly the closing of schools without a comprehensive community-driven approach and solution. At the same time, I am a strong advocate for creating schools that are beacons of opportunity. And I think that we can get there without a knee-jerk approach to just simply closing schools. An alternate way would be to really, really focus, and again, with an elected board, not under the leadership of an emergency manager, but really focus on interventions that can drive change at schools that were previously failing. And I agree with Governor Snyder on certainly one thing, and that is this district has not had enough time or opportunity to independently prove itself on that point.
Sonia, what do you hope that you and I will be talking about 1 year from now?
I hope that 1 year from now we will do a look back and we'll say, you know, wow, that board, they really did get it right on the permanent superintendent selection. They really did get it right on EAA integration and transition. They have really created an environment where both students and teachers can thrive and meet their potential. And I hope a year from now we'll be talking about what this board is doing in terms of planning out 5 and 10 years from now, and not just reacting to an onslaught of what I call fire drills, if you will.
Sonia Mays, board member for the Detroit Public Schools Community District, beginning work this week. Thank you so much, Sonia.
Thank you.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Lots and lots of auto news this week as the North American International Auto Show opens with media previews and model rollouts. Auto Trader senior analyst Michelle Krebs is with us now from the very, very busy floor at Cobo Center in Detroit. The Car, Utility, and Truck of the Year honors were announced today. The Chevy Bolt EV, Car of the Year?
Well, it's an interesting mix. So this year, for the first time, the North American Car and Truck of the Year jurors added a utility category, which makes a lot of sense. And the Chrysler Pacifica minivan won that. Makes perfect sense that the wonderful utilitarian family hauler. Car of the Year was won by the Chevrolet Bolt, which is an electric vehicle that costs about $30,000, less than a typical vehicle in the U.S. It goes 238 miles on a single electric charge. And then, interestingly, you know, Detroit's known for trucks, but it was the Honda Ridgeline that won the North American Truck of the Year.
Designed in Marysville, Ohio, and built in Alabama.
That's correct.
And this is the truck that strives to give us a car-like ride and better fuel economy?
Well, I think everybody's moving in that direction. We've seen that with sport utility vehicles. They try to make them as comfortable as a car because they are so popular with individuals and families, with all the creature comforts as well.
About the Bolt EV, how much of a game changer is this vehicle?
It's significant because this is the first mainstream, you know, reasonably priced car, you know, that a mainstream family could buy one, for example, and it goes the longest distance on a single charge. And the other thing I think that's interesting about the Chevrolet Bolt, it beat Tesla to the game. Tesla is coming out with the Tesla 3, which is going to be priced in that $30,000 range and have a long range. It can travel on a single charge, but it's not out yet.
Interesting. Is there a theme you think that unites these three choices?
Innovation, you know, well, the Chevrolet Bolt is very innovative and breaks through the clutter with something very new. The Chrysler Pacifica really raises the bar in its category, and that's always one reason the jurors vote for vehicles. And then the Honda Ridgeline, again, raises the bar in that truck segment.
GM CEO Mary Barra spoke Sunday, Michelle, at the unveiling of its revamped GMC Terrain, which she said they'll be building in Mexico instead of Canada. Did she address the pressure from President-elect Trump to, you know, build them where you sell them and that threat of the stiff tariff on vehicles imported from Mexico?
Well, it's interesting. As I say to people, President-elect Trump is not here, but his presence is felt intensely. Everybody is discussing what does a Trump presidency mean to the auto industry. Yes, Mary Barra spoke on that. She's one of his economic advisors. They haven't laid out what their game plan is in terms of their Mexico plan. I just left a Fiat Chrysler briefing with Sergio Marchionne. They made an announcement of $1 billion investment in jobs and plants and products here in Michigan and Ohio. And he's begging for clarity. What is the policy going to be in terms of tariffs and such? So there's a lot of concern. There's a lot of questions. And basically the attitude is, we'll accommodate, we'll adjust to whatever. Just tell us what it is.
And, you know, speaking of questions and the person in the room who's not really in the room, and that would be Donald Trump.
Mm-hmm.
Under the current fuel economy standards, the CAFE standards, automakers have to meet some very tough standards by 2025. But it is very possible those standards could change with the new Trump administration. If that happens, Michelle, what happens to all this technology that the carmakers have been planning for to meet those standards?
Well, yes, the fuel economy standards become much more stringent in 2025, but there is a 2018 review. Basically, we're hearing manufacturers say, let that review continue as planned. It may well be that they get rolled back, they get pushed forward. Again, it's one of those, we don't have clarity on that issue. But here's the deal. Even if they do get rolled back, the rest of the world is marching forward with much more fuel-efficient vehicles and low-emission vehicles because air pollution in other places is pretty intense. And also we have California, which is the biggest car market in the country, and they are adamant that they are going to move forward with low-emission vehicles.
So big changes in this kind of policy, interacting with the long-range planning for car makers. How does that fit?
If you're going to be a global company, you have to address the needs of the entire world. And so the rest of the world, even if we roll back fuel economy and emission standards here in the U.S., the rest of the world is marching in that direction. So global automakers like GM and Ford still have to move forward in that regard. And frankly, technology is another big theme at this show, and I don't see any let up in any of that.
Michelle, there was some other auto news, if you will, over the weekend, and the fact that a top Volkswagen executive was arrested in Florida in connection with the emissions scandal. Oliver Schmidt was VW's compliance officer here in the U.S. He was based in Auburn Hills, and he's accused of being a part of the scheme to rig cars to beat emissions tests. And I believe this is the first time a top exec has been arrested?
I believe that's correct on criminal charges. And I guess it's not surprising because the Volkswagen situation was very different than, say, the Toyota sudden acceleration and the GM ignition switch situation. This was a deliberate deceit. And so it's not shocking that criminal charges came down. And I don't know if there will be more, but we'll stay tuned on that one.
Michelle Krebs, senior analyst with Auto Trader, checking in from the floor of the North American International Auto Show at Detroit's Cobo Center. As always, Michelle, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Creation.
Entrepreneurship.
The next idea.
We have to make room for this ability to learn to be creative.
The realities of a world economy aren't just being felt at the big companies, the GMs, the Fords, the biggies who can move jobs to Mexico. Small businesses feel the strain of foreign competition. Our latest contributor to The Next Idea directs a federal program that's aimed at helping small local businesses adjust to that foreign competition. Scott Jacobs directs the Great Lakes Trade Adjustment Assistance Center, centered at the University of Michigan. Good to have you with us, Scott.
Great to be here. Thank you.
Tell us exactly what is TAA, Trade Adjustment Assistance.
TAA is a long-time program, and when most people talk about it, they're thinking about a retraining program for workers. That is a very large program, and it is really the main program that is designed to help people after they've lost their jobs mm-hmm. due to imports. However, there's a small component of this program, which is what we run, which is called TAA for Firms. And that program is really designed to help small companies after they've been hurt but before they go out of business.
to guide them through some stormy waters and hopefully get them to calmer waters.
Exactly. I mean, most of the companies we work with have been in business for many years. I mean, we're working with a company right now that's been in business since 1891. And, you know, having multi-generational firms is very common for us. And any company that has been in business over the last two or three recessions for 20 years is doing many, many things right. And our role is really to, you know, help them steady themselves and identify ways that they can improve their business and their competitiveness, and to remain employers and, you know, important parts of our community.
What does the assistance look like? It's clearly advice and guidance and consulting. Is there money involved as well?
Yes, there is. It's a very interesting assistance model. The idea is that we help companies step back and do some assessment of their situation and some planning. But importantly, what we do as part of that is we identify specific projects and improvements that they need to make. We help them determine whether they have the internal capabilities to do these things themselves or if they need some outside assistance to be able to spearhead those. For the projects that they need outside help, we help them identify private sector providers, consultants, trainers, engineers. And then we help them hire them on a contract basis, and we typically pay for half the cost. So the whole idea of the program is really to help companies invest in themselves more quickly and efficiently than they could to really build their capabilities and their capacities.
The amount of money that a company might get, I saw a figure something like $75,000 was one figure I read, which wouldn't mean a lot to a GM or Ford, but if it's a small tool and die company in a small town, that's a lot of money, isn't it?
That is exactly right. One of the ways to think about it is the most a company can qualify for through this program is $75,000 of assistance towards implementing projects. However, you know, if you ballpark that, consultants range widely in cost, but at $150 an hour, and we cost share usually 50-50, so that's $150,000. That's 1,000 hours of outside expertise to come into a company and help them make improvements in, you know, their sales function, their production, their accounting, their worker training, be that what it may. So yeah, if you think of it as $75,000, it's not a lot. But if you think of it more as helping bring in very targeted expertise, it's a significant impact.
And these are companies that are not going to be packing up and going to other countries. They are rooted in their community.
Small manufacturers, you know, are a community asset. They are, you know, part of the communities. They've usually been there for many years. Those are jobs that, you know, small towns, large towns depend on. So yes, that's exactly so, and that is a significant difference between the kind of companies we work with.
And as director of the Great Lakes Trade Adjustment Assistance Center, so we say Great Lakes, it's one of 11 that the government has set up, so it can be very nimble, and the aid can be tailored to what the region needs?
We cover all of Michigan, all of Ohio, and Indiana. That is a large area and also very manufacturing-centric. It's about 14% of the U.S. manufacturing base. Also, there are very large industries based here. The markets that our companies mostly serve are fairly significant and industrial. So we at the Great Lakes Center work with many industrial component suppliers, machine shops, tool and die shops, plastic injection molders. However, the program is national. It allows centers to work with the employer base that's there. For example, out on the West Coast in the Northwest, there's a center that has a large population of salmon fishermen, and they have traditionally worked with fishermen quite a bit. Down in Texas, there are a large number of small food processors, mom-and-pop organizations that make food products. They end up working with many of those kinds of companies. So yes, it is very nimble and able to be tailored to the kind of employers that are within the area.
We're talking with Scott Jacobs, who's director of the Great Lakes Trade Adjustment Assistance Center, as we look at the ways this federal program can help small local businesses. What countries are your clients tending to lose the most business to?
Well, it can be pretty much anywhere depending on the industry and the markets that they serve. However, China, of course, is the very big competitor in the room. Also, because of our location, Canada because of, you know, what has driven our manufacturing economy here or did in the past was the auto industry. Mexico is also a very key competitor that small manufacturers find themselves up against.
And what kind of advice do you give these small manufacturers who are, you know, losing business to China or Canada or Mexico? What are some of the things you can help them understand?
One of the most important things I think, you know, for your audience to understand is, as I think I mentioned before, these companies have been in business. They're doing many, many things right.
They've weathered recessions. They've weathered horrible times.
Indeed, they have. Oftentimes, you know, the kinds of things that a company needs to do is really to sharpen up some of the practices or skills that they're already doing. You know, one of the big keywords that's around is diversification. And many of the companies we work with do diversify. That can be into completely new markets, or that can be providing new products to existing customers. Most of the companies we work with, in fact, I would say over 80% of the companies we work with, we help them do both top line and bottom line projects. By what I mean is, top line is going to be focused on increasing sales, and the bottom line is going to be focused on improving the cost structure and increasing the productivity. But, you know, this program really is able to take wherever a company is and whatever situation there is and step back and help them get to the next level. And usually, you know, that means multiple projects across the different functional areas of the company.
In the many, many years, because this program has been in existence for several decades now, you've got to have a lot of success stories. Can you talk about one of these?
Sure. One of the issues we've got is because to be able to get in this program, a company must be distressed. And so we're very careful and cognizant of, you know, not to discuss the specific situations of companies we work with.
And when you say distressed, on the verge of collapsing?
Well, short answer, yes.
Yeah.
However, the program really has two broad requirements to be able to be eligible. The first is a company has to be distressed. And the second is that a significant portion of that distress has to be directly identifiable to having come from losing business to imports. However, distressed is defined within this federal program as decreases in both sales and employment.
Okay.
Most of the companies we work with have suffered double-digit drops in both sales and employment, you know, from the year before. So they are typically in fairly significant distress. For example, there's a tool and die and machining operation, you know, that we were working with in central Michigan that was largely focused on supplying the auto industry. They had a lot of very strong engineering capabilities and had capabilities to be able to do much more than the kind of work they were doing. So what we helped them do is to really expand their markets into aerospace and medical device. But to do that requires a lot more than simply saying, oh, let's go find these customers in aerospace and medical device. Industry certifications were needed. And then also some training of their sales force to actually understand how to approach these different customers. So diversifying from one market into another, you know, is a fairly common strategy that companies use. However, that is incredibly hard.
Mm-hmm.
Something that is more common even than that is diversifying within your current market. We're working with a Michigan company that manufactures orthopedic goods right now. They sell through distributors. However, of the top 100 distributors in the U.S., they're currently only selling to two. So, I mean, the major focus there is really to identify and approach additional distributors of the same products they're making and try to support them and help them sell their goods.
How does a company find you?
Most firms that we work with end up being referred to us by different organizations. However, we also, you know, do public outreach and do presentations and that. And what we really try to do is direct folks to please go look at our website, which is at gltaac.org. That's GLTAAC.org. And that's because what we're going to do with a company is we're going to work closely with their management team. And before they make any decisions about working with these crazy people from the University of Michigan, you know, they really want to get a better understanding, taking their own time to take a look at, okay, who are these people and what do they do? Going to our website is a great way to find out about our organization and the kinds of things that a company can utilize the program for.
A small federal program at a university that has the prospect of making a big difference for small businesses.
That's exactly right.
Scott Jacobs, director of the Great Lakes Trade Adjustment Assistance Center, and that website again is gltaac.org. Thanks for being with us on The Next Idea, Scott.
Thank you for having me.
Support for The Next Idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. The Write Michigan Short Story Contest is the only fiction contest that's exclusive to Michigan writers. It's a joint effort of the Kent District Library and Schuler Books of Grand Rapids. The contest is now in its fifth year, and submissions are up 200% from last year. Heidi Nagel is with the Kent District Library. Heidi, welcome.
Thank you so much, Cynthia. I'm excited to speak with you.
This must be exciting to see submissions up so much over last year.
Absolutely. Well, it's kind of a work in progress, and one of the things that we've found is that the writers who participate one year come back the next year. So we've been able to not only grow our audience, but have repeat submissions from writers all around the state.
What gave you that idea of starting a short story contest that's exclusively for Michigan writers?
This idea was originated with our executive director at Kent District Library, Lance Werner, who was listening to an NPR story on Michigan radio about the challenges that publishers were having in vetting and finding quality writers. Everybody is looking for that next big breakthrough bestseller, and we kind of thought about it and thought that one of the wonderful areas where writers live and thrive is in their local public libraries and in their independent bookstores. So it just kind of became a partnership with Schuler Books and their imprint Chapbook Press, and we thought we could generate this opportunity for writers all around the state, and we really wanted it to be for young people as well. So it just sort of launched the first year. We weren't quite sure what to expect, and now we're in the fifth year, and we've added a Spanish language category this year. We're very excited to provide that inclusive opportunity for residents in Michigan. It's just a wonderful event and an opportunity for people who may be sort of laboring on their stories in secret around the state, and this is a chance to bring them all together.
Put them out in the sunshine.
Exactly.
Get those stories out there. And so adding that Spanish language category now gives you four. So you have youth, young adult, adult, and now Spanish language. Who can participate in the contest?
Any resident of the state of Michigan is welcome to participate in the contest. The contest runs from the beginning of September through the end of November. Right now we are in the process of reviewing all of those stories. Each submission is reviewed independently and anonymously by two different volunteer reviewers, and that's how we determine the top 10 semifinalists in each category.
What does the winner get?
Well, the top 10 semifinalists, then those stories go in a PDF format on the writemichigan.org website for public voting, and we present a $250 cash prize for the reader's choice in each category. So that's solely based on the public vote. Then we also have our judges' choice category, and there is a winner and a runner-up. The winner receives a $250 cash prize. The runner-up gets $100 in each category, and we have different sort of celebrity judges for each category. Often that includes the winner of the previous year's category, then becomes a judge. So it's a great way to kind of keep them in our family for Write Michigan and also give them an opportunity to share the wonderful positive experience they've had with other writers.
And I gotta imagine for a writer, it's not so much about the dollar amount, but the artistic nourishment, if you will, of having something that you've been working at in private out there and also winning acclaim and winning votes.
Well, yeah, it's winning acclaim, it's winning votes, and then the second piece of that is also that they get their story published in an anthology and they become a published author. So we do an anthology with Chapbook Press of Schuler Books of the winning stories of the Judges' Choice runner-up, Reader's Choice, and then the top three vote-getting, we call them published finalists. So each category has five or six stories printed in the anthology, and then, like I said, they all become a published author at that point.
I'm interested whether geographically you find, do your writers come from any particular areas of the state, or is it all across Michigan?
It is all across Michigan. We've created a Google map that I'm looking at. We have submissions from Houghton all the way down to, I think it's Three Oaks, right on the Indiana border. We've got submissions from Bad Axe, from Boyne City, just all across the state. We've really worked hard to promote the story contest through all different venues around the state. We work with Michigan libraries all around the state to promote it. Many libraries have writers groups who meet in their facilities. They really help to partner with us, promote this opportunity to people in their regions and geographies around the state. It really is a broad distribution. We've reached out to schools all around the state and spoken with teachers. A lot of teachers, particularly in high school, may make this a creative writing assignment. And we get great submissions through that around the state as well.
Heidi, what have you learned personally about writing in Michigan, writing by Michiganders through doing this contest over these past few years?
Every year we do an award ceremony, and we have Michigan author who writes the foreword to the anthology and presents the keynote address at the award ceremony. And we follow that with a book signing. I will tell you, it is the most rewarding thing I've done in 20 years as a librarian, is to see particularly the young people. They come, they're dressed up, they're nervous, they sit at a table with their little name badge on it, and complete strangers come up to them and tell them how much they enjoyed their story and ask for their autograph. And what I have learned is that there are people all around Michigan who are incredibly talented, who have been holding a story in their heart, and when they share that with others, they are rewarded and it can change their life and they realize their dreams are possible. That's what libraries do, and I'm so excited about that. So your listeners can go to writemichigan.org beginning on January 9th, take a look at the top 10 Send My finalists in all four categories, vote for their favorites, and then on March 22nd, we will have the awards ceremony and the anthology will be available. People can order that anthology from Schuller Books and have that sent right to their home wherever they live.
WriteMichigan.org is the website. I'm excited. I'm going to go check them out. I adore short stories. Congratulations on keeping and encouraging this art form alive and thriving in Michigan.
Thank you so much, Cynthia. It's an honor to be able to do that.
Heidi Nagel with the Kent District Library. And again, the website is WriteMichigan.org. Thank you so much, Heidi.
Thank you.
What really caused the Flint water crisis? The obvious and well-known answer is the April 2014 decision to begin drawing the city's drinking water from the Flint River. That, in turn, caused corrosion in the city's lead water pipes, and that caused lead to leach into people's drinking water. Others point to Governor Snyder's appointment of an emergency manager to control Flint's affairs. That happened in late 2011. But Michigan State University public health expert and urban geographer Rick Sadler argues the true cause of Flint's water disaster goes back decades. Sadler and co-author Andrew Highsmith have published a study that lays out their case in the journal Environmental Justice. Rick Sadler, welcome back to Stateside.
Yeah, thank you for having me again.
What are we missing, Rick, when we lay blame at the emergency manager appointment or the switch to the Flint River?
Yes, when we look at those, we're looking at the outcomes of a whole bunch of policy decisions. And so we're missing the bigger picture of state policy that supported suburbanization for many decades and made it easier for suburbs to prevent cities from annexing the developments that sprung up on their properties in the post-war era. And so as our cities continued growing, it meant that the internal, like the core cities, weren't able to capture the tax base that was growing beyond their boundaries. And so as people moved out and out, it meant that cities increasingly became places where poverty was concentrated, where there were fewer jobs, where educational systems started declining. And the state propped up this system by encouraging suburban movement.
I love a quote of yours that I read where you talk about these series of policies that made it easy for people to go frolicking off into the farmland and ignore the infrastructure that was already built. But you really did put it well. That's what was happening when we're talking about the 50s and the 60s.
Yeah, and I admit that's a little hyperbolic, but it's effectively what we've been able to do. And don't get me wrong, I don't hate on suburbs, but the problem I have is that we as a society don't pay the fair price of living in those suburbs. There's a lot of invisible subsidies from freeway construction to new infrastructure construction to the FHA loans that our families got to move out to the suburbs. And people don't really realize that if they live out in, you know, in a cornfield somewhere or out in a suburb, they're getting a bigger chunk of government subsidy than somebody who lives in a city.
And here, as you say, the infrastructure is already there in the city, but then it becomes ignored and untended to as we see population and dollars leave that city.
Yeah, and that's why I say, frankly, you know, I don't think of this as a political issue, but I think that building denser cities is fiscally conservative because it's supporting the development that doesn't increase public infrastructure spending. It doesn't mean that the government's going to try to force us all to live into Soviet-style apartment blocks. It means that we're taking responsibility for the infrastructure that we've already built.
Rick, tell us about this economist who promoted this urban development model that, as you point out in your study, really hurt Flint.
Yeah, so it's called the Tybout model. And the basic premise, and this was developed back in the 40s, 50s, it assumes that regions are better off when municipalities can compete with one another for tax base, which in theory isn't a bad thing. You know, it can make sense. It can work in certain situations. But the problem is that nobody wants the impoverished populations, the elderly populations, racial minorities. And so it doesn't deal with the social equity problem. And so for Tybout, in his time, the question wasn't about civil rights and social justice and so forth. And it just didn't really pop up. You know, he's thinking, how can governments be more efficient? Well, they can be efficient by competing with one another. And you get the same kind of idea with proposals to amend the healthcare law. You know, more competition will make it more efficient.
Or school of choice, even, when we think about
exactly. that. Yeah. In some cases, these kinds of proposals are more or less attractive. But again, because we don't deal with the social justice problem, it means that the populations who are from poorer populations or from racial minorities wind up concentrated in one municipality. There's, you know, zoning laws that can be passed that kind of implicitly exclude affordable housing and different housing types that segment the population not only by race but also by class. And then the problem with this is that research has shown again and again that these fragmented regions are places where there are greater health and educational inequalities between races and classes.
So what Charles Tybout, the economist and geographer who came up with this in the 1940s, that idea just built and built and then came down like a landslide on Flint.
Right, yeah. And I don't think that he would have predicted that Flint's economic decline would have been as severe as it was either. I mean, a lot of people back then were concerned that Flint had no economic diversification. It was like the least economically diverse city in the country back in the 60s.
It was a company town.
Yeah, exactly. But I think people just assumed that it would keep growing. And as long as Flint was growing, it didn't matter so much city, suburb. You know, everybody had a bit of a slice of the pie. But then as the pie started getting shrunk a bit, meant that there were increasingly winners and losers in that, they call it like municipal Darwinism, you know, the competition between municipalities.
There's still an inclination to want a culprit, to blame someone. Who do you think, Rick, that someone should be? Is it the people who picked up and left the city decades ago, or the policymakers, or something else?
Yeah, I definitely wouldn't blame the individuals who left. It is hard. It's hard to find the specific culprit. But, you know, you look at the individuals who left, the individual family was just seeking better schools or safer neighborhoods, bigger yards, lower taxes. Like, there's lots of decent, honorable reasons that people wanted to suburbanize. It's the whole American dream thing. Like you say, we have to look at the policies that were designed to promote and subsidize the suburban living at the expense of cities. So, you know, if we're going to look at who to blame, it's kind of a hard question, but I guess I would just look at, okay, we collectively screwed up, our policies screwed up, and so what can we do now to address that? And that means more pro-urban policies. It means making the subsidies that the suburbs get more plain, like making it more apparent that these are places that are less efficient in delivering infrastructure and are spending more of the public dollar on roads.
And do you believe the public and political will is there to do exactly that, to kind of rethink policies about our big cities? Because I'm sure this is a story that is not just confined to Flint, Michigan.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's where we run into another linchpin, because I don't think there's a lot of political will to talk seriously about this, because there is still such a perception that suburbs are somehow distinct from and absolved from responsibility from their core cities. You know, even looking at a more recent policy change in the last 15 years or so, where the state of Michigan changed their revenue sharing structure. And so cities have lost out on millions and millions of dollars that the state previously would have sent back to them from taxes. And the Detroit News has written about this, and others have started talking about this. The Michigan Municipal League has a campaign right now called the Save My City series. It basically amounts to the fact that if the state of Michigan hadn't cut revenue sharing, the amount of money that Flint would have received over the past 15 years or so would have been way more than their debt when the emergency manager was installed. So effectively, just even on that more proximate cause of the crisis, Flint never would have had an emergency manager if Michigan hadn't cut the revenue sharing. And that at least is some form of policy that reflects regional understanding, a need for there to be regional collaboration.
How do you sell that message to the policymakers in Lansing is the big question.
Yeah, I mean, I would kind of frame it like, and I use the kicker in the article that appears on MSU Today, I think it's in there. There's that old Flint City Commissioner saying, those of you who feel you'll escape by running to suburbia, beware because blight recognizes no border lines. And I think that is important because we're starting to see increases in inner suburban poverty and, you know, declines of educational and infrastructural systems in our inner suburbs. And so it would be foolish to assume that, you know, oh, well, I live in an outer suburb. It could never happen to me. You know, if it happened in Detroit and Flint and then it happened in, you know, inner suburbs, Royal Oak, Southfield, Burton, Flint Township, there's no reason to believe that the cyclical process of urban development couldn't eventually affect places that are less efficient and lower density and provide infrastructure at a higher cost.
Rick Sadler, Michigan State University urban geographer and assistant professor of public health. His study, along with co-author Andrew Highsmith, can be found in the journal Environmental Justice. Great to talk with you, Rick. Thank you so much.
Yeah, you too. Thank you.
Support for the next idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.